Hi, this is Bob Harrington from Stanford University here on Medscape Cardiology and theheart.org. This week, I've really been thinking through some of the issues and some of the news on prescription drug prices in the United States. And certainly, this was a big topic in the last election. It was a big topic when Rob Califf, cardiologist well known to this audience, was put forward for nomination as the FDA commissioner. A lot of discussion raised by Senator Sanders and others around pharmaceutical prices. And so I was really struck over the course of this last 6 or 8 months on two papers that have appeared in the Journal of the American Medical Association. One is by Aaron Kesselheim, entitled The High Cost of Prescription Drugs in the United States, and the other was led by the senior author, Kevin Shulman, on financing and distribution of pharmaceuticals in the United States. And so these have really got me thinking that perhaps this would be a good time to have a conversation with a guest about why prescription drug prices in the United States are so high. Are there things we can do about it? How is policy being made in this arena? And again, what are the things that the listener ought to know? And what are the things that the listener might think about in terms of potentially even getting involved in this topic from a healthcare policy perspective? So I'm really pleased that a colleague who authored one of these papers has agreed to join us for the conversation today. Our guest will be Aaron Kesselheim, who is an associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, a member of the Division of Pharmacoepidemiology at Brigham and Women's Hospital, and the director of the Program on Regulation, Therapeutics, and Law at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. Aaron, thanks for joining us here on Medscape Cardiology.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Aaron, as you heard in the opening remarks, this topic of the high cost of prescription drugs in the United States has certainly gotten a lot of airplay, including in the election, as I mentioned, and including in actually the last two confirmations of FDA commissioners, Rob Califf and Scott Gottlieb. I'm hoping that one of the things you can first do is maybe you've worked in this area for a long time. Walk the audience through some of what I'll call prescription drug pricing 101. What does the community really need to know? And then we'll get into maybe some of the key things that you talk about as methods in the policy arena that might be able to be adapted to really rethink high prices of prescription drugs.
Sure. So I'm happy to try to give a little bit of an overview, but I think the fundamental point that people need to understand about prescription drug prices in the U.S. is that prescription drugs cost whatever the market will bear. And that is far different from the way that prescription drug prices are set in other countries, where they're set based on some evaluation of the value of them and the clinical effectiveness that they provide. And the government or the payer in those settings makes a decision about how much the drug is worth. In the United States, we don't do that, and we let the market decide whatever the price of the drug is. And as a result, per capita spending on prescription drugs in the United States is about double what it is in some other high-income settings. And the reason that is because in addition to letting the market decide whatever the price of a drug will be, we also give market monopolies to pharmaceutical companies. And if you have a monopoly, a patent, or some kind of regulatory exclusivity, and you don't have any competition, then you can set your price at whatever you like. And the other component of that is that we can make it very hard for the payers that do exist to negotiate lower prices against these market monopolies. So there are substantial restrictions on government payers' abilities to exclude products from their formularies. Medicaid programs, for example, have to cover nearly all FDA-approved drugs. There are 6 different protected drug classes for Medicare Part D. There are various state laws that put rules on private payers about what they have to cover. And so when you have a marketplace that is defined by monopolies that exclude competition, and you undercut the ability of payers to negotiate, you have basically a market failure, and it allows prices to rise substantially above what happens in other countries.
Let's get into some of the specifics, because I think that's a terrific overview and has covered some really key points. For reference for our listeners, if you want a view of some of the things that Aaron's talking about in the complexity of how pharmaceuticals are financed in this country, take a look at the DeBoer paper, which is, as I said, with Shulman as the senior author that addresses some of this. But Aaron, one of the issues that you bring up has to do with the monopoly that's granted to a pharmaceutical company who has developed a product and then has brought it to market. And then, as you've, I think, rightly said, what really happens in this country is that the price is charged as to whatever the market will bear. And we can all give a lot of examples about this.
One of the pushbacks that you, I'm sure, have heard and that I know you address in your article is the so-called innovation premium. Well, if we really want to be a country that is innovating in the space of pharmaceuticals, then we're going to have to pay this premium, this innovation premium, in terms of the price that's ultimately charged. And because of the way that the different governments are working around the globe, for better or worse, the U.S. consumer ends up being the primary group that's paying that premium. You don't buy that there's a relationship between driving innovation and the price, do you? At least that's what I took away from your paper.
Well, it is important to say that the revenues that companies receive on the drugs that they sell is part of the capital that they then have to invest in research and development. But I think it's also important to point out that companies only spend about 10 to 20% of their revenues on research and development. Far more money goes to marketing and administration. That's more like 30 or so percent. A lot of money that the big pharmaceutical companies make go to shareholders. And so not a lot of that money goes to research and development. And when you consider truly innovative research and development, like the cures of tomorrow, actually, some estimates suggest that large pharmaceutical companies spend less than 5% of their revenues on that, that a lot of their revenues are spent on changes and tweaks to already existing products. In fact, if you look at some research that we've done, most of the truly innovative, most transformative new products emerge from publicly funded science that occurs in academic medical settings and government laboratories. And so just as long as we continue to fund the NIH at its current levels and perhaps even more, given the fact that NIH funding levels have been mostly flat over the last 15 years, then we will continue to have innovation, the sort of most important new innovation, come through. I think it's important to recognize, of course, that there is a need to ensure that drug companies have a way of making some revenue on their products. But I think it's also important to recognize that there is no relationship between investment in research and development and drug prices. The price of a drug is not related to how much it costs to develop. It's related to whatever the market will bear. And I think it's also important to sort of step back and think about where innovation really does come from, and to think about whether the prices that we have for drug products, is it necessary for the prices to be what they are to receive that innovation, or are there other ways that we can try to make sure that we both get the innovation that we need and ensure appropriate access to those products for the patients who need them?
Yeah, I think you've brought up some really important points in this notion that's a really important one for our listeners to think about. Is that, as you've noted, much innovation comes out of academic laboratories where a new pathway is discovered, a new molecule is discovered, and certainly the whole idea of the Bayh-Dole Act to take university discoveries and to bring them to the commercial markets is a good one in terms of, as you've said, to promote innovation. And the question really becomes, how much are we limited in our ability to charge a reasonable amount for our drugs, based on what kind of profit people feel that they need to continue to drive this innovation? And you've raised some really important and interesting points. One thing I wonder if you can comment on, Aaron, if you've done work in this arena. In cardiovascular medicine, some have said that we're at an innovation stalemate. There has not been a lot of innovation in cardiovascular drugs in a long time. Now, part of that is the challenge that drugs like aspirin and the ADP inhibitors and statins and beta blockers and ACE inhibitors, and a variety of other novel antithrombotics, a variety of other interesting drugs, have now been around long enough that many, if not most of these, are generic drugs. And there has been this push, for example, to really go after unusual diseases, rare diseases, certain types of cancers, because the investors, including the companies themselves, feel as though there's more money that the market will bear. Have you done research on this to understand where the investment is going in this country and how we might tip that balance?
Well, I think that's true. And actually, we have published a paper recently in a journal called JACC, Basic to Translational Science, in which we looked at trends in cardiovascular drug development over the last 25 years. And actually, Commissioner Califf wrote an associated commentary with our paper. And indeed, it is the case that there has been a slowdown in the number of novel cardiovascular medications that have been moving through the pipeline. That being said, we have seen that the number of first-in-class and more innovative products has maintained its levels. I think that there are still a lot of great ideas out there, and those ideas are being pushed forward. You raise a really good point that there was a kind of a golden age of cardiovascular pharmaceutical innovation in the 1970s and 1980s. A lot of new products were discovered and hit the market for hypertension and cholesterol and other cardiovascular diseases that had substantial efficacy. And now a lot of those products, again, after substantial amount of spending on them during their monopoly periods, a lot of those products are now available as generic products. Generic drugs, in general, offer patients the best value that there is in the healthcare product marketplace. Particularly assuming that there is enough competition from generic manufacturers producing them. And so a new product coming out there will have to take that into account and decide what value can this product offer patients on top of currently available evidence-based therapy with the drugs that already exist. And that's exactly what we want. We want drugs that will move the care forward in important ways and not just offer treatments that are similar to what we can already provide to patients with a relatively low cost through generic drugs. And so I think that when we have new products in this market, I think we want to make sure we test them against currently available therapies and show how they work, if they're safer than available therapies or more effective than them. And I think that this is the current environment that people who are trying to innovating in the cardiovascular therapeutic space are working in. I think that the fact that the current market pays a lot of money for cancer drugs that may not be substantially much better than what we already have, but they can be sold to patients in certain ways, is troubling policy that would then take funding away from other investments that could be made in more potentially game-changing cardiovascular therapeutics. And so that's why we need good policymaking in this area and oversight to ensure that patients are using appropriate medications and that there are appropriate incentives out there for the researchers and scientists who are working in this area.
Yeah, and I think that's really well said, and I think you've hit a really key issue, which is how do we generate more evidence about newer therapies versus established therapies in ways that people then have a high quality of evidence upon which they're best able to make decisions, whether that's a decision being made by a provider, a decision being made by a patient, or hopefully a decision being made by the two together about what the best choice looks to be based on evidence and not based on things other than high quality science evidence. But I'm hoping in the last couple of minutes, one thing that I really enjoyed reading in your paper had to do with this notion that we really, as a policy perspective, need to give government payers, I think you called it, a greater opportunity for meaningful price negotiation. And this is something many people are not aware of. CMS in particular is not able to negotiate in ways that could be most effective on price for pharmaceutical products for their beneficiaries. Do you want to comment on that so that the audience knows about this issue, and then talk a little bit about what you see as policy that could take place that could help this?
Sure. So again, the essential point is that part of the reason that drug prices are so high in the U.S. is because we do not have a very well-functioning pharmaceutical market. In a well-functioning market, there would be equal or close to equal power between the buyers and the sellers so that they could optimally come together and negotiate what the reasonable price is for a product. And that's definitively not what we have in the pharmaceutical market. We have a pharmaceutical market where one group has a monopoly and another group, the payers, in this case, have substantial limitations on their ability to negotiate. So in the case of government payers, for example, there is a rule that Medicare Part D is not allowed to negotiate on behalf of the individual Medicare Part D plans. As a result, the sort of larger discounts that could be achieved because of the scope of the Medicare Part D program and the, you know, millions and tens of millions of lives it covers are not able to be achieved. Similarly, there are protected classes that all of these Medicare Part D insurance companies have to cover, all or substantially all the drugs that are in those classes. And so it makes it hard if you're negotiating a price to be unable to walk away from the negotiating table, and that substantially hamstrings payers' abilities to try to bring high-cost drugs prices down. Now, obviously, if there's a drug out there that's a really effective drug and there's no reasonable alternatives, either pharmacologic or non-pharmacologic, to it, then that drug is going to be able to command a high price no matter what. But there could be good ways that these payers could try to bring prices down if we were to give them more authority to do that. And an organization like the VA in the government actually has substantial authority to set an evidence-based formulary and to decide what should or shouldn't be covered. And as a result, the VA prices are among the best prices that the government gets. I think that in terms of policy, we should be thinking about ways of trying to achieve an evidence-based formulary that the government can use to identify products that's going to be covering and to determine prices for it, determine what value is or what a valuable drug is, and be able to use comparative effectiveness research to make those decisions. Unfortunately, in the U.S., we don't have a lot of funding or organizational structure in which we make those kinds of value assessments. So I think another policy option would be to try to think about ways of ensuring adequate funding for conducting rigorous comparative effectiveness research so that physicians and patients know what the most valuable drugs out there are and can be directed to take them and not waste their money on drugs that don't offer substantial value over lower priced options.
One of the things that I'm certainly hopeful for, both as a prescriber as well as a researcher, is your last comment about we really need more funding through things like PCORI and now the new not-for-profit PCORNet that's been formed that really does take a patient-centered perspective on this and is very interested in how to conduct high-quality research around comparative effectiveness. I could not agree with you more on that, Aaron. Aaron, this has been a really fabulous discussion, and I'm hopeful that our listeners will go and take a look at your paper in JAMA called The High Cost of Prescription Drugs in the United States. I want to thank you for joining us today. Our guest has been Aaron Kesselheim, who is an associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and a member of the Division of Pharmacoepidemiology and Pharmacoeconomics at the Brigham and Women's Hospital. Aaron, thank you so much for engaging with the Medscape audience today.
All right. Thanks very much.